and welcome to episode 135 of Speak Beastie for October 3rd, 2021.
I'm Anne.
I'm Jeff.
I'm Marjolaine.
And I'm Shannon.
First of all, we'd just like to thank our support for this episode. Our Patreon support comes from Katie Carty Hiley. You probably know her if you listen to Alohomora. She's just a great person, and we are so thankful for her support. Thanks, Katie.
Yay!
Thanks, Katie.
She's also my boss.
Wow! I'm going to pretend that's at your muggle job, not at like your MuggleNet job.
Yeah, I wish Katie was my boss at my muggle job, because then we'd be hanging out talking about pod stuff like all the time and we'd be getting paid.
Nice.
That would be fun.
Yay.
So hi, everyone. How are we doing? It's spooky season. It's October. When this episode drops, it's going to be spooky season.
Hooray.
Yes. I love it.
Oh, that means it's the official return of Spook Beastie.
Do we get a fun logo for that? I can't remember. Like, this is basically, I think we're coming up on my 1 year anniversary of actually being a part of this.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's
congratulations.
True.
Yeah, because now I'm trying to do the math. Math is difficult for me. It was me and Marjolaine, you were there. And was it Ario, my first episode?
I think so.
Because we were doing the last 10 minutes of Crimes of Grindelwald. And I wasn't even supposed to be a host on that episode. I was just like, hey, can I get in on this doodle poll thing that I see? And Ashley said, yeah, sure, you can do that if you want. And then I got picked.
And the rest is history.
Riveting story.
Let's see here.
And then we never got rid of him.
It's true. It looks like your first episode was October 18th, episode 122, The Other Percival.
Oh, so almost exactly.
Yeah, wow.
Wow.
Yeah, and in this past year, a lot happened, but for us, I think this past week was the most exciting.
Oh my gosh.
Speaking of,
yes, let's go ahead and rip open that Phoenix Register, shall we?
Oh yeah.
And now a message from our sponsors. Hey you! Yes you! The magical cats and dolls waving your wands like bean shooters in a caper. Looking to be on the up and up about Newt Scamander, famous zoologist and world traveler? No need for gossip at the juice joint, just tune your ears to Speak Beastie. And now for as little as one dragon dollar a month, you can make Speak Beastie the Neasles Meow. Support the show at patreon.com and suddenly you're the big cheese, the real McCoy, with exclusive access to swell sneak peeks, bloopers, and behind-the-scenes features. But wait, there's more! Sponsors can also beat their gums at the joint with access to the Speak Beastie Common Room on Facebook. Now you're really on the clean sweep, flyboy. Get a wiggle on to patreon.com/speakbeastie to learn more about becoming a sponsor today. It's the Billy Wigs Knees, and how.
So, it all happened, like on Tuesday. So I'm in the office 3 days a week, at home 2 days a week, and all of this is happening while I am in the office and do not have access to my phone. So I can just hear it going bzz, 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 bzz. And I, oh my God, I had to talk to people. It was the worst. Anyway, so we have a title, you guys.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's new.
It is.
I did not expect that at all.
No.
I did not expect to get a title. The title itself is fine, but I didn't expect a title to happen.
Like, you just expected it to be called Fantastic Beasts.
I don't know. I just, like, I guess I was more like, when are we going to get the trailer? It didn't occur to me that we'd probably get a title announcement first.
Let's be honest. They could probably have just announced that they're going to call it Fantastic Beasts 3. And we probably would have found a way to be okay with that, especially in light of the fact that they have moved up the release date by 3 months instead of pushing it back again.
They should have just called them Fantastic Beasts 2, Fantastic Beasts 3.
I mean, Disney got away with it with Frozen 2.
Would it be any worse if they had? Would it have been any worse if they had done that?
No, I mean,
no.
I think we need a title, but yeah, no, I, like you said, I think the most exciting part of this day was the release date.
Yeah. So,
well, so let's, we haven't said what the title is.
Yeah, the title is officially Fantastic Beasts, colon, The Secrets of Dumbledore.
Yeah.
Ooh.
We're going to get to read his Dumble diary that has all his secrets in it.
So yeah, and so that's a title, we will talk about it, but many people guessed this title. I think nobody was surprised with it. Yeah, just in the Speak Beastie community, I know that Sophie guessed it, that Helene also guessed it. So yeah,
we just have really smart staff members.
We do. We have a very beautiful and smart staff. We're very lucky.
Yeah.
And it's not a very, like, it's not like this title changes everything. Like,
yeah, no. It's not like it's, you know, the flower arranging skills of Nagini or something. I mean, that would be a movie.
Yeah, that would have been like, whoa.
That needs to be something. It doesn't necessarily have to be a movie. Like, I need that to be, like, going? Yeah, the flower arranging skills of Nagini. Now that you've put that out in the universe, I need to see it.
All right, awesome. So, what do we think the secrets of Dumbledore are?
I might have stolen this idea from MuggleCast. That Albus Dumbledore, up to the point where we've met him in the Fantastic Beasts films, has really only had to keep his own secrets and his family secrets, but as he delves deeper into having to take a more active role in combating Grindelwald, which then kind of pivots into having to figure out how to fight Voldemort, he has to learn how to keep secrets of international security. So he's having to gain all this intel on other people and then kind of keep it close to the chest until it's the right time to share that information so as best to combat evil. So I think this is where we're gonna probably see most of Dumbledore's personal secrets and how it's kind of gotten him here, and then that's gonna turn into Dumbledore having to keep secrets that don't necessarily belong to him, but he understands why they're important.
Okay, I discussed this title a lot with friends and with people from La Gazette du Sorcier, and yeah, I think one of the ideas that came out during the discussion is that Dumbledore, it's not only Albus, so yeah. Not even talking about Aurelius, but talking about Aberforth. So yeah, maybe the secrets of Dumbledore, it's not only the secret, secrets of Albus Dumbledore, it can be the secrets of other member of the family, and or the secret of the family Dumbledore as a whole. So yeah, that can be a way to expand the secret not being just Albus's, but yeah, of course everything will be connected to him, I guess.
So it's not just the secrets of Albus Dumbledore, it's the secrets of the Dumbledores.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think so.
Yeah.
I mean, Richard Coyle is still uncredited on IMDb. So.
I don't trust IMDb.
I mean, okay, but.
But they credited everyone else.
Exactly. That means that his role is a spoiler. So I wonder if, like, if he is Aberforth, like, I wonder if we find out just, like, maybe a week, or even if we don't find out at all, we find out in the movie.
Yeah.
And I wonder if we see the goats and the inappropriate charms.
Maybe that's the secret.
Maybe that's the secret.
Okay, or if that's the secret, that's going to be kind of a bummer. Like, that can be one of the secrets, but if that is the secret, then I'm going to be kind of put out.
No. Yeah, but, I mean, The last scene of Crimes of Grindelwald, it already is teasing Dumbledore's secret. So,
yeah,
that's something that is, I mean, that's the answer that we want to have. It's why Aurelius? Who is Aurelius? How
no.
Aurelius?
No.
How is Aurelius?
No.
Why is Aurelius?
No.
What is Aurelius?
How
was
I'll
Aurelius.
Do you one better. Which is Aurelius?
That's a good question.
So, I mean, yeah, that's why so many people guessed this title. It's why what we are expecting at the end of the movie. So yeah.
It's interesting that for, you know, the second and third one, they followed this format of the blank of blank, which the first movie obviously isn't that, but I'm curious if, like, 4 and 5 will also be that same title format, you know?
Yeah.
Like Fantastic Beasts, the
Pastries of Jacob.
The Pastries of Jacob.
Yes. I wouldn't mind if they did it that way.
Can you imagine if Fantastic Beasts 5 is The Return of Graves?
Oh.
Ooh.
Return of the Graves. Here it is. Return of the... Nobody? No? Dang it.
Sorry.
Showing my age.
I want the last movie to be The Tears of the Phoenix.
Ooh.
I would love that.
Because that last movie, which is definitely happening, because we're getting 5, that has been established, do not take this away from me, is going to have that fight scene in it in 1945. And somehow Tears of the Phoenix feels really appropriate for that.
Yeah,
because it's sad, it's also healing, because it's the Tears of the Phoenix, not a healing property. No, I want this title. Oh, I want it.
So, I like it.
It'd be a good title.
Yeah, but speaking of the logic or not, I don't know, of the three first title, not that we have three, we can try to look if there is a logic in it. So I have a theory. I don't know if that's what was intended, but I think every title represents Newt's lens, his main focus during the movie. That's why in the first one we have, the most important thing, beast and where to find them. That's the only thing that matters for Newt. And the second one, he opened his eyes on Grindelwald's crimes. And most importantly, we have the crime of killing Lita at the end, which is the most important event that makes him, that makes Newt choose Dumbledore's side. And so that's not Grindelwald who is important. It's Newt lens. Newt focus on the title, and so the new one, The Secrets of Dumbledore. Yes, I think we will talk about the synopsis later, but we know that now Newt had chosen a side, so maybe not know that he has maybe a leading role in the fight. He will face Dumbledore with his responsibility and understand that maybe Dumbledore is keeping too many secrets and they are putting everyone in danger. So that's why Newt will be focused on these secrets. It's because they need to discover these secrets to win. So I don't know.
I really like that.
I love this
analysis.
That's my way to try to put Newt in the center, because otherwise we cannot feel Everyone say, oh, the focus will be on Dumbledore. Yes, but Newt is supposed to still be our main character. So if we consider that, that's his problem. That's Newt's problem to deal with Dumbledore's secrets. That's more, letting Newt be the main character.
Mm-hmm. Yes, let us please try and keep Newt centered in this Newt-centric franchise that is rapidly not becoming Newt-centric anymore.
That would be great.
Yeah.
So, as we alluded to earlier, we do have a new release date. It was originally, I think, July 18th of 22, like that.
That sounds right.
Something, no, maybe.
We've already forgotten.
Mid-July. I know, it already mid-July, doesn't matter. Yes. And now it is April 15th of 2022, so we are...
Tax day!
As of the date of recording, we are a little bit more... than 6 months out, which is suddenly to go from nearly a year out to 6 months is a huge change. Like, what?
Ooh, yeah.
I have to tell you guys what my wife said when I told her this release date. And I did the math to figure out how far away we were from this release date. My wife actually said, do you realize if we got pregnant today, this movie would arrive before that baby?
Yup.
And all I could think to say to that was, well, I would hope so.
So just out of curiosity, I was looking to see what other movies were releasing that weekend to see what it was up against, what WB's long game here is here, if there is a long game that's immediately obvious. So there's also Lost City of D with Brad Pitt, Sandra Bullock, and Channing Tatum. It's some kind of romantic adventure comedy, as far as I can tell. And then Bad Guys with Awkwafina, Anthony Ramos, and Marc Maron, which seems to be about a group of thieves that go straight. So, there's no other big, like, tentpole fantasy releases happening that weekend. Yeah, and Marjolaine, I think you've got a good point about this.
Yeah, because, I think that's all about Warner Bros. Replanning by looking at the big Marvel's release or Disney planning, because Disney already had a very clear plan for their release in 22. So they actually, if they have left Fantastic Beasts in July, it would be just 2 weeks after, 1 week or 2 weeks, I don't remember, after Wakanda Forever. Mm-hmm. So, a bit of a competition there.
It would be the week after, because it was July 15th, because Wakanda Forever is coming out on the 8th.
Yeah, so, too close. So, and April is actually the only month in 2022 that doesn't have a big Disney movie coming out. So, so I think that's exactly the
Disney needs to chill plan. Out, honestly.
Yeah, actually Disney plan a movie every 2 months. So,
good God.
Yeah.
Is that all?
And not Disney, only Marvels. I'm talking only about Marvels.
I mean, is that all? Like every 2 months? Yeah. Because it feels like I cannot log into Disney Plus anymore without Marvel telling me, hey, by
Disney
the way.
Plus is not another thing. I'm just talking about theaters release. I'm not talking about TV shows.
Yeah.
No, I know. I'm just saying that, especially since Disney Plus is a thing and they have the TV shows now, it feels like Marvel is just churning them out.
They are busy bees.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think they try to have a big blockbuster release between the two big studios every 3 weeks, actually. This year will be packed with blockbusters. But during the spring of this year, we will have a Warner Brothers and a Marvel big release every 3 weeks. We will start with The Batman, and next we will have Doctor Strange, and next we will have Fantastic Beasts, and next I think it's I don't know what Marvel movie came out in May, but there is one. I don't remember which one, but Guardian of the... No, it's later. Anyway, and later in July, Warner Brother put another movie at the end of July, Black Adam. So I think it's also to let Black Adam have more space that they push. They bring Fantastic Beasts earlier. So
May is Thor: Love and Thunder.
Yeah, Thor. Okay.
Yeah.
Such a great title.
Wow,
yeah, that's a lot.
I really hope people feel safe going in the movie theaters by next year, because
the content
there's gonna be
real.
A lot of time in there.
The other reason is that they start to have the box office result for the movie coming out right now. Mm-hmm. And they are pretty good, at least at least here in France. It's totally the blockbuster are doing very fine. So we have Dune since last week, and it's crushing the box office. So that's a very good sign for Warner Brother, I think. So go back to the cinema, guys.
In addition to everything else that we got a plot summary. This is from...
Did we?
I mean, it's
a synopsis. Something very...
It tells things about a movie.
Does it?
It's words about the movie.
Which movie is it about, though? Because honestly, I read it and I actually had to check and see, wait, was I on the page for Crimes of Grindelwald or am I on the page for Secrets of Dumbledore? Because this feels like the movie that we just got. Not that I didn't love the movie, because I did. But this summary was the least exciting part of the announcement for me because it did not give us any information.
Yeah, just in case anyone didn't see it, I'll just give it a quick read. Jeff is right. It basically could sum up Crimes of Grindelwald as well, but... All right, quote, Professor Albus Dumbledore knows the powerful dark wizard Gellert Grindelwald is moving to seize control of the wizarding world. Unable to stop him alone, he entrusts magizoologist Newt Scamander to lead an intrepid team of wizards, witches, and one brave muggle baker on a dangerous mission where they encounter old and new beasts and clash with Grindelwald's growing legion of followers. But with the stakes so high, how long can Dumbledore remain on the sidelines? And that is from Wizarding World Digital.
One issue that I have with that description, why did we go through the whole charade of establishing that he's a nomad and that there's different... It's confusing to call him a muggle baker.
Well, because this description is written from Dumbledore's point of view.
Also, this is from Wizarding World Digital, not Makusa Digital. So
Makusa Digital.
Now, this is the one difference from Crimes of Grindelwald is it says Newt is leading an intrepid team of wizards, which Newt was not doing in Crimes of Grindelwald, at least not on purpose.
He was kind of the de facto leader?
No, he was not leading a mission. He was going
to try to find Teela.
Well, Jacob certainly wasn't leading that mission.
Nobody was leading any mission.
There wasn't really a mission to be led. It was mostly just people running around Paris looking for each other.
Yes,
it was Leonard and Sheldon from the Big Bang Theory going to Paris.
Yeah, but I think that's the big change between movie 2 and movie 3, or will be, is that this time Newt is accepting Dumbledore's mission. He's not in Crimes of Grindelwald. That's not for Dumbledore that he's going in Paris. So this time it's more like he knows. That's exactly what I was saying about the title earlier. That's I see here that we will have a change in Newt's characters because now he has chosen a side, and so he's leading a mission. Leading a mission is not in Newt's character. Leading a team, that's something that he will have to learn to do. For now, it's just, Jacob, do you want to go with me? Cool, let's go. That's the only thing that he does.
You know, it kind of makes me think, you know how every Marvel movie is a Marvel movie and also some other kind of genre of movie? Winter Soldier is a Marvel movie that's also a Cold War movie. Shang-Chi is a Marvel movie that's also a Kung Fu movie. Mm-hmm. It kind of makes me like Fantastic Beasts, the first movie, is a Wizarding World movie that's also a buddy comedy kind of thing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Crimes of Grindelwald is a Wizarding World movie that's also kind of a spy movie. Mm-hmm. And then maybe Secrets of Dumbledore is a Wizarding World movie that's also a 30s adventure, Indiana Jones.
Yeah,
kind of movie.
That's what I want.
Okay. I would love that.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm here
for
that.
Yeah, thinking about the mission, and if we remember that they were going to Brazil and to Berlin, yeah, that's exactly what we want in the Indiana Jones movie. So, yeah.
Yeah, the description that they have here, the leading intrepid team of which on a dangerous mission, they're encountering old newbies and clash with Grindelwald's growing legion of followers, that sounds like an Indiana Jones movie. It sounds like a 30s adventure serial.
Man, imagine Indiana Jones, but instead of Indiana Jones, it's Newt Scamander.
It's Newt Scamander!
That's so good. Just this little soft boy.
I love it.
He's walking by a shop and he sees a fedora in the window and he just says, no, I could never pull that off.
No, not on my hair.
And then Teela wears it because she's I don't care.
Oh, Teela would look great in a fedora.
The other thing that I was excited about in the synopsis was old and new beasts. Because the Fantastic Beast in the title was so small. I'm glad they at least appear at the center of the synopsis.
That was something else that was pointed out on MuggleCast that I never thought about before, is with all the Harry Potter movies, Harry Potter is big and the rest is small. It's Harry Potter in the Chamber of Secrets, Harry Potter in the Order of the Phoenix. But it's the other way around now. It's Fantastic Beasts, the Crimes of Grindelwald, Fantastic Beasts, Dumbledore's Got Secrets.
They're still putting the names bigger.
Yeah.
Because that's mm-hmm. what people recognize.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think people are going to recognize Beasts. The name Dumbledore more than Fantastic Beasts.
Yeah.
So then if they keep that up, are they going to have to put characters' names in the rest of the titles to keep that consistent?
I think they're going to have to put recognizable characters' names, which well, it might mean that the flower ranging skills of Nagini could still be a...
I mean, that's kind of what I was wondering with the title, and if they're going to follow this format, is it's like, well, you've used Grindelwald and Dumbledore.
Yeah, who else do you have? Because anyone else of like from the core four or of the new character we met, none of them have name recognition from the Harry Potter series. Yeah.
The goats of Aberforth.
Aberforth Dumbledore, totes magotes.
It'll be like, the last movie will be called like Fantastic Beasts, The Rise of Voldemort.
Ooh, oh my god. No. From your lips to God's ears, Shannon.
I will admit that was my initial reaction to the title Secrets of Dumbledore and people freaking out about it on the internet. I thought, well, at least they didn't call it The Rise of Skywalker. That title meant nothing. We won't get into it.
The Rise of Dumbledore actually would have kind of been more interesting. That would have been more like, what does that mean?
Yeah, that
does talk about Albus.
Rise of Dumbledore does feel kind of catchy.
Yeah, because then it's like, well, are you talking about Aurelius? Are you talking about Albus? Are you talking about, who are you talking about?
Yeah, and I think the last two one will be, I mean, I hope we will have two more movie after this one, but it will probably be the big finale in two parts. So maybe the title will answer each other. If I still want the Tears of the Phoenix, it will be The Rise of the Phoenix and The Tears of the Phoenix.
Oh, that's good.
But yeah, I think there is already a lot of movies with the Rise of the Phoenix title, so I don't know.
But the Ashes of the Phoenix.
But there will probably be a war of something. War aspect
Fantastic
in the title.
Wars and where to fight them.
Fantastic Wars!
And how to fight them. To fight them.
Fantastic Beasts, Fantastic Wars, and how to fight them. Yeah, I was looking at the Hunger Games movie logos, and it's actually the same thing in there, where it's called... the first one is obvious, it's called The Hunger Games, and then the second one, The Hunger Games in a smaller font, Catching Fire, then The Hunger Games, smaller font, Mockingjay, in larger font.
Yeah. Interesting.
Anyway, so, speaking of the logo, it's got Dumbledore's wand in the D. If you look closely, it's got the Elder Wand's very iconic outline carved into it.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Maybe I was just really tired when I first saw the logo, because what happened was I went to sleep after I got home from work. I woke up and I looked at my phone and the world was on fire, and I didn't realize that it happened because I put my phone on Do Not Disturb while I'm sleeping, and I get like a billion messages about this. So I'm looking at this logo through half bleary eyes thinking, oh, they named it something. All right. And then it was mainly comments about how people feel about the title. I didn't even catch that the wand was in there.
Yeah, actually, you know what? I'm so sorry. I'm looking at the logo. It's actually not the Elder Wand, because that would be Grindelwald's
wand. No, it's Dumbledore's
wand at this time. It's Dumbledore's wand. My apologies. Yeah, yeah. And Newt's wand, actually, now that I'm looking at it.
Really?
Yeah, if you look under the Fantastic Beasts, it looks like Newt's wand, because his wand has that kind of open... Oh, it kind of it's a bit wider at the base and then kind of tapers down.
Oh, yeah. Maybe. Cool.
Neat! Anyway, logo!
Yeah, but I like the fact that they... We talked about that with Amy when we did this little Instagram Live the day we got the news. This logo is so shiny and silvery and very bright. Far more bright than the Crimes of Grindelwald one. So yeah. I like it.
I like it better than the current.
Yeah, same.
I mean, it's the same, like, format, but...
It's pretty clear that they have paid attention to what a lot of people's complaints, at least just based on what little we have so far. It seems like they've really paid attention to the complaints about what didn't really work about Crimes of Grindelwald, and they're trying to fix those things.
I think so,
well, you
yeah.
Know, the that... Crimes of Grindelwald logo, they did like every word had a letter in it that was not just a letter. It was something
right,
else.
There was so much going on.
Yeah.
Which it was like a craft
more
project.
To think about, but I don't need that in the logo.
Yeah, it was an interesting logo, but yeah, in the end, like in the Crimes of Grindelwald, we had the Deathly Hallows, the three of them, and it doesn't make a lot of sense not that we have the movie to have the three Hallows. We just have one for now. So yeah, that was a nice idea, but I think the guy or the girl designing the logo wasn't aware of what would be in the movie.
Probably
something
not,
nice.
Honestly.
Yeah. So for this one, it's safer. I mean, the only thing recognizable is the Dumbledore's wand, and Dumbledore is in the title, so at least it's safe that it makes sense.
And the final, is this the final thing that we got? It...
Hope so, because yes, okay. It's been like a half hour and we're still on the Phoenix Register. We haven't even gotten close to our
main discussion.
Yeah.
But
we had such a good main discussion. So.
But we have a really good main discussion. So anyway, the last thing we got is cast information. Again, from Wizarding World Digital, quote, many of the characters you know and love from the first two Fantastic Beasts films will return, such as Eddie Redmayne as Newt's Commander and Jude Law as Albus Dumbledore, along with Ezra Miller, Creedence / Aurelius Dumbledore,
No.
Allison Sudol, Queenie Goldstein, Dan Fogler, Jacob Kowalski, and Catherine Waterston, Tina Goldstein. Comedian and actor Jessica Williams, who had a brief appearance in Fantastic Beasts, The Crimes of Grindelwald, will return as Ilvermorny Professor Eulalie Lolly Hicks, while Mads Mikkelsen will debut as Gellert Grindelwald. And, like, my whole takeaway from this, did we know that Eulalie's nickname was Lolly and I love her?
I think we, yeah.
I want to call her Eulalie Lolly Hicks every time I talk about her because it's fun to say, Eulalie Lolly Hicks.
What a name, yeah.
So this is nothing we didn't know already. Doesn't mention Richard Coyle. Doesn't mention, who's that other dude, Oliver something, who's, I mean, I guess he's probably not a huge character, which is probably, he's probably not mentioned, but.
Yeah, Oliver something, he was in that thing.
Yeah, he was in that thing with the stuff, you know.
This is just a list of people who are returning.
Yeah.
I gotta be honest, I'm glad we have the title, the release date, everything that we did get, because these days, if we get anything, we should, I feel like, be grateful for it. But if I had a mirror of Erised in front of me right now and I looked into it, it wouldn't show my own reflection. It would show me exactly what Mads Mikkelsen is going to look like as Grindelwald. Because here's my theory.
Oh, yeah.
As much
we'll have as that soon.
I know that there are, as much as I know there's people out there who think Johnny Depp is hot and then Grindelwald was really weird and ugly, I have this weird feeling that I'm going to have this bizarre crush on Grindelwald after I see Mads Mikkelsen play him.
Oh, yeah.
It might just be because I've never seen a movie where I didn't have a crush on Mads Mikkelsen.
Same.
Fair enough.
Even when he's the worst of the worst villain, he's still Mads Mikkelsen. So, yeah. No, but I think now that we have a release date so much earlier, we'll have at least the first photos very soon, I am sure, and a trailer not too late after, or maybe at the same time, I don't know, but we will have more very soon, I'm sure. Yeah. And speaking of the cast list, I noticed someone missing in there, and I looked at IMDb, and she is not quoted either, and it's Claudia Kim.
She'll be there.
Man, you're right.
I mean, she's the only one not mentioned. So,
but I think
she'll be there.
Yeah, I think she'll be there. They just didn't list her because she's not as recognizable.
But you said she's not on IMDb either, right?
No, and we have so many.
I don't trust IMDb. I think I mentioned that.
You did. Yeah. But I mean, like, Kama is listed on IMDb, isn't he? Even though he's not necessarily listed in this.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was listed in another one, Wizarding World official thing
okay.
a few months ago about the movie.
So. I'm looking right now. I'm seeing other things that listed her as part of the cast earlier.
Okay. Well, fingers crossed.
So I think she'll be in it, but they just didn't feel the need to include her here. But who knows?
I was thinking that maybe it was one of those things where even though we now have a sooner release date, they're still working on the final cut and some people's parts have been scaled down so much that they may end up not making it into the film. So rather than announce their participation now, they're just going to wait until they confirm that these people are definitely going to have their scenes in the movie.
Possible.
Then they'll acknowledge it.
You know, Kama's not on IMDb either.
Yeah. He was earlier, but was pulled out.
Yeah, see, I mean, anyone can edit IMDb.
Mm. That's true.
So,
yeah. Well,
you know,
so it doesn't mean anything.
Other sources it's not always accurate, but it's a good resource, obviously.
Luckily, Theseus is still listed, so my heart remains unbroken.
Yay!
Okay, so that is our super size Phoenix Register for today. Phew, let's all just take a minute to relax and, like, decompress and maybe hang out with some cool owls. What do y'all think?
Yeah, just sit and watch the owls fly by.
I think we have a letter.
Wow.
We just got a letter.
We just got a letter. I wonder who it's from.
Okay, so this owl post is from Megan, not Megan from the show. But Megan, the new listener. Megan said, hello, I am a new listener, and decided to jump right into the discussion surrounding the upcoming Fantastic Beasts 3 film. Fantastic Beasts, The Secrets of Dumbledore. While listening to the episode on Bunty, I found myself wondering whether or not you think the possible meaning of the name Bunty being lamb could suggest that Bunty may act as a sacrificial lamb in the next film. Could Bunty possibly try to protect Newt or the creatures and die in the process?
No, don't.
If she has a bigger role in this upcoming film, perhaps she will try to aid Newt in his attempt to save Credence and defeat Grindelwald. Also, as a complete side note, I can imagine Bunty and Aberforth together, and I'm enamored with this pairing. Thank you for keeping the fun of Fantastic Beasts alive, despite all of the controversy surrounding the franchise. I really appreciate all that you do and hope to join the Patreon soon. Keep being amazing people. Thank you, Megan.
Thank you, Megan.
So working and backwards, thank you for saying nice things. And then also, the headcanon of Bunty and Aberforth. Yay!
Yes, that's so cute.
Isn't that precious?
Yeah.
I love it. Yeah, I didn't know I wanted to see that, but now that's a new thing that I want in this movie.
Can you imagine how awkward it would be? They would be so sweet.
Yeah. That would be cute.
I love that. Yeah.
She'd be like, I like your goats. Part. And he'd be like, I like your Kelpie.
Oh, so cute. No, this part is cute. I want to forget the first part.
Yeah, let's forget about the bit where Bunty gets fridged for Newt's character development. I don't want that. I don't want that so hard.
I think I could maybe see Bunty dying or something else happening to her, but I don't think in the next movie.
Okay.
And I don't know if I would have it. Like, I could.
Not every character exit has to involve death.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can just not include characters in the next movie, and people can just make up in their heads what happened to the character. You don't have to kill everybody.
Yeah, maybe she would just meet Aberforth during the mission and just decide to stay with him. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that's it. We don't need anything tragic to happen to her.
I could see her, like, getting injured to save a beast or to save Newt.
And staying with Aberforth, taking care of her.
I would hope she doesn't die. But, like, I can see something like this happening. I could see that. And then that would be the moment where Newt's like, oh, like, she's a human. She's not just this girl who takes care of my beasts.
Oh, I've been treating her like crap this whole time. Oh, no.
Oh, no. Am I the problem?
No, it can't possibly be me. Anyway.
Am I the drama? No, I'm not the drama.
I think it's a good instinct, though, that Yeah. Something. I think you're right, though, that I feel like having the second movie ending with Leetah sacrificing herself, and then having Bunty sacrificing herself in the third movie, that's setting up a bad pattern.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But I think that these are good instincts.
Yeah.
And right, welcome to the family, all. Megan. We love that you.
Yeah, we hope to see you in the common room soon.
Definitely.
Yeah. Goodbye, owls.
Bye, owls. Thanks for hanging.
I love you.
So, we still have a main discussion because...
Did we not do the main discussion yet? Yikes.
Apparently. I mean, it's a main discussion, which is also kind of one of our segments, the movie magic segment. Yeah. So, yeah, we can consider it's also kind of a long segment.
It's a big Muggle movie magic.
Yeah.
So we were like, this will be the main discussion.
Yeah.
Marjo had a great idea, so...
Yeah, I got this idea because recently we got a fascinating interview of James Newton Howard, so the composer of Fantastic Beasts soundtrack, and in the great podcast, Score the Podcast. So if you like me, soundtrack, score, and great composer interviews, that's the podcast for you. It's really interesting. And in this interview, he mentioned his work on The Secrets of Dumbledore and says, I'm super excited about the Beasts movie. I think it's by far the best one. It's really good. Mads Mikkelsen is playing Grindelwald. He's so great. And it's just great. It's full of magic and scary stuff and romantic. It's just really fun.
Ooh.
So it's great.
It's great.
Is what it's great. I'm hearing.
I like that he mentioned scary stuff and romantic. Yeah. That's what we like. And that's kind of Indiana Jones too. So.
Yeah.
I'm glad you found that episode. You said that episode came out recently because I went trolling for podcast interviews with James Newton Howard to listen to prepare for this episode. And the one that I found was actually while he was working on the first Fantastic Beasts movie. So it was several years old. And maybe I just didn't look hard enough, but I didn't find any recent ones. And I was disappointed.
Yeah, no, this one came out earlier in September. So yeah, it's very, I don't know when it was recorded, but I think since we know where they are in post-production, I think it's a fairly recent interview. So.
Well, thank goodness you're smarter than me.
But I already knew this podcast, so yeah, that's... And thankfully, with being in La Gazette du Sorcier, I know everything because we have super, super good people who knows everything, every news. So yeah, that's... Mm-hmm. That's nice to have that too. So anyway, so today we want to talk about James Newton Howard and of course his work on the first two movies, because obviously we don't know how the music will be in the next one, but yeah. So James Newton Howard has an immense career. He's 70 years old. And he did so many movies and a lot of great ones. So, yeah, I want to know everyone's favorite film he scored, besides Fantastic Beasts, of course. Do you have a favorite?
I don't know about a favorite particular theme, but my favorite score he worked on was actually one he did with Hans Zimmer, and it was the score for The Dark Knight. And I mentioned that older interview that he did on the score. He talked in that one about how when they did the first Batman Begins movie together, that for him, even it's difficult to point out which bits of that score were him and which ones were Hans Zimmer, because they were so closely intertwined in how they worked on that one. But it was a little different when they worked on The Dark Knight, because like he did the Harvey Dent stuff and Hans Zimmer did the Joker stuff. And I really feel like Harvey Dent is an underrated character within the Batman universe, Harvey Dent, Two-Face, just because there's so much potential there. And Aaron Eckhart didn't get enough credit, I think, for how he did that part. But to be fair, they kind of pared that down a little bit. He didn't get to be Two-Face for very long in that movie. But the theme that he comes up with for Harvey Dent on the soundtrack, it does such a great job of really showing that kind of duality of here's this very moral, upright guy on the one hand, who's trying to use his position to do good, but then he's kind of starting to morph into that darkness and that corruption that just kind of comes with having to play the political game, which is where he ultimately ends up in the movie.
No, that I agree. That's brilliant. And you're right to mention The Dark Knight, because I think most people only remember Hans Zimmer. And like you said, it's a two-man job in this score. And it shows how James Newton Howard is so good at writing themes and motifs that tells the story that we see on screen. And he did that with Hunger Games. Very well too, I think. I mean, everyone remember Ruth Farwell. It's used also in it's used in the first movie, and in this theme came back regularly in the following movies. And it's so every time it's at the right moment in the right tone, and it's just perfect. So yeah, that's one of my favorites too. And I also love Peter Pan, the movie from 2003. Yes. This score is not on Spotify, and I'm so mad about it because it's so good. And yeah, I love this score. I was obsessed when I was a teenager, and I'm still obsessed. The fairy dance title is just so beautiful, so magical. I mean, if you need a proof that he is one of the best to write magical fairyland themes, that's the one for you.
It's oh, sure.
Yeah. And more recently, he's busy. He's doing a lot of work. And recently, he did Raya, The Last Dragon, and
I
it's
really like
so
that.
Good.
Oh, that soundtrack is so good.
So
and
I think
what's really, like, important about Raya is it's, like, it's not a Disney musical.
Which yeah,
no.
You kind of expect it to be, but it's like, but the music still had to be really important. It's
had a lot of those moments where the score becomes so important when you have really long action sequences where there's not a lot of dialogue.
Yeah, there's not a lot of dialogue.
When you listen to a soundtrack for a film score, you can kind of tell the difference between the moments where the music is really meant to just kind of underscore the action of what's going on because there's talking or there's something happening underneath, and those moments where in James Newton Howard does this brilliantly where he kind of switches back and forth between those moments and the moments where it's like there's nothing much going on right now. We might have sweeping landscapes, or we might have just characters who are moving along doing their thing, not talking to anybody. And those are the moments where composers really get to kind of use those motifs like Marjolaine was mentioning.
I was listening to the Fantastic Beasts score before this episode, and it is like, obviously I know the first Fantastic Beasts movie pretty well and I know the plot and stuff, but you can really listen to the score and get like I think you could listen to the score and really get the emotions of the movie. Like, you wouldn't know the actual plot, but you would get where the ups and downs are from just listening to the score. I think he's really good at that.
And I just wanted to mention that he's one of these composers that I know some pieces, even if I don't know the movie. So I never saw the Village from
Shyamalan.
Shyamalan. I don't know how to pronounce the name. But because I think it's too scary for me, and I'm not sure. But
it's also not a good movie. Sorry.
Yeah, I don't know. But The Gravel Road, this piece is so... I love it. I don't even want to see the movie, but just it's running in my playlist for so long, and I love it. So
you know what? I'll be this person. I thought The Village was a good movie.
Okay, you can think that. That's fine.
Especially if you... Oh, can you at least agree if you ranked all of M. Night Shyamalan's movies from best to worst that The Village would be closer to best than worst?
I mean, yeah, overall, it's not a bad movie, but I just remember, because, I mean, of course, by that point in his career, you go in knowing that all of his movies have a twist, and I just remember
like his
that
third
realization.
Movie.
Yeah, but you still know that all of his movies have a twist.
Yeah.
And I just remember, like, that moment of realization about 20 minutes in that I was like, oh, I figured it out.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe that might be coloring my perception of the movie.
I mean, at least it has a nice score, so.
That's true.
James Newton Howard has done most of M. Night Shyamalan's movies.
Yeah.
Okay. Cool. I don't know this filmography, so. Yeah. Do you want to mention other stuff?
I would love to mention the most embarrassing pick on here, which is he also scored the recent Jungle Cruise movie with Dwayne Johnson and Emily Blunt. And it's good. You know, it's got that kind of 30s adventure river cruise feel. One of the things that I love the most about the actual Jungle Cruise ride is the music in the queue, which is kind of like the 30s music with radio pattern. He does a good job translating that into the score. And it also includes a random cover of a Metallica song. That is in there.
He's talking about that in the podcast that we mentioned.
Why is it in there? What does he say?
It's kind of random. And actually, he said that it was really, really funny to see people trying to find meaning of why this music. And it was just because, I don't remember exactly the reason, but the way he talked about that, it was just something fun for him.
Incredible.
And a good occasion to work with Metallica. So.
Incredible.
Other than like Raya, he's done a lot of the like kind of forgotten animated Disney movies.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He did Dinosaur, Atlantis.
Yeah.
Oh, there was another one. I was just looking.
It's not Treasure Planet or something.
Yeah.
Oh, it was Treasure Planet. Yeah.
Which the Treasure Planet score, especially, I really like. I really like the Treasure Planet soundtrack in general.
Treasure Planet had a song in there by John Resnick, and I honestly thought, I just assumed at that point, I was still very young and didn't understand how these things work. I assumed that whoever wrote the score also wrote the song that becomes like the song associated with it. John Resnick his name's John Resnick, right? From the Goo Goo Dolls? That's him?
Yes.
I'm going to say that's him until somebody corrects me. But he wrote this really, really great song that I still enjoy for Treasure Planet. And I assumed because he wrote that song that he wrote the rest of the music too. Because at that point, I was an ignorant child who did not know that James Newton Howard was a creative genius.
Yeah.
I mean, or that he existed.
Yeah, it's John Resnick.
But yeah, and I think like all of those Disney movies, but including Raya, and I haven't seen Jungle Cruise, but I assume Jungle Cruise, they all kind of have those like sweeping landscape kind of moments. So I think obviously someone at Disney is like, oh, this is a visual movie. We need James Newton Howard.
Yeah,
probably. And so going back to how he's currently working on The Secrets of Dumbledore, one of the most interesting parts for us is that he talks about it in the podcast. So I quote some part of it, of this part. I just presented David Yates with the first six reels for Fantastic Beasts 3. I've been working on the material I just showed him for 4 months. These are ideas that I have been shaping, close to 2 hours of music that I sent him. And there's a whole bunch of notes from David Yates, and it's okay, I'm okay with that. And David's notes are extremely clear, and I can't argue with them because I get it, you know. It'd be like, you're missing the point, or you're missing, this is the thread that really matters in the story. This is something that isn't ultimately the most important idea, and I don't feel like we're really underscoring that in the way we should be. So, yeah, that's... end of the quote. And I think it's interesting because for once we can give credit to Yates that he's working very well with his composer, because they always underscore the big, important, meaningful, emotional moment perfectly. And I think it's a real collaboration between the two. In the podcast, Howard said that he's good at understanding what the what they want in the movie, and I think it's always on point on the right moment. So
film composers have to be able to work fast, and they have to be able to rewrite fast.
Yeah.
And it's insane the amount of stuff they write that doesn't get you. I mean, he just said he sent him 2 hours worth of stuff. There's going to be scenes in this movie that don't have music or that reuse music. So 2 hours of music won't be needed. And that's just what he had sent him so far at that point. And it's crazy, kind of. Yeah. But even at the age of 70, having written the scores for all these movies, all these accolades, like, he is one of the most established film composers in the business, and he's still getting notes from the directors he's working with that are saying things like, I think you're kind of missing the point of this moment.
Yep.
Isn't it crazy? As much as he's done, as many times as he's done this, especially working within the same franchise, that he still has to get notes like that?
Yeah.
Yeah. And he says in this moment, I didn't quote it, but he says also that it's normal for the director to send this kind of notes, because for how many months David Yates was working with, I don't know how they say that, the technical term, but he was working with template music. I don't know how they say it, okay. Like that. But another music that was not the something taken from another thing, to just work with that. And so it's hard for a director to forget the template music that he was working with.
Oh, sure.
While, so there is always a time... of adjustment between the two, but
and I think it's you know, it part of being a good composer is being able to take notes. I mean, part of, you know, being a good collaborator in any way.
Yeah,
so that's just part of the creative process.
Yeah, I think it's good that he's like, yeah, I get notes, and that's great.
Yeah, but the way he talks about that in the podcast, we will share the link to listen to it, because it's really, really interesting. But moving to other his style, does he has a typical Newton Howard style? I think we said that he does a lot of different type of movie, and every time he adapt to the instrument to fit the mood. We talk about Raya, it has a lot of Southeast Asia feel. But if we are just talking about Raya, the theme of Sisu, the dragon, it feels very close to Newt's theme in Fantastic Beasts 1. And I think that's just a fantastical, magical creature vibe he loves to do.
Speaking of choir stuff, when I was re-listening, I don't know why I never thought about this, but in preparation for this episode, I listened to the soundtracks for both Fantastic Beasts movies we have so far, and apart from noticing that the score for Crimes of Grindelwald is significantly heavier and darker than the first movie, which is appropriate, there is text. It's not just the choirs going ooh and ah and oh and all these neutral syllables to provide, you know, the right kind of ambiance to the moment. There are moments in that score that have text, and I can't find the text anywhere. I assume it's Latin. It sounds Latin-y.
I never catch that.
Yeah, same.
I swear it's in there.
Oh, interesting.
Huh.
Like, it's in the more dramatic moments. I want to say that it's in the moment, like, the... where he's just had his meeting, and he does the fire, and everything's starting to get really heavy and dramatic, and people are starting to die. And then there was another one earlier in the film. I can't remember now which one it was. It might have been the Thestral chase scene at the beginning. But there is text, and I want to know what it is and what it means.
So, James Newton Howard, we know... you are listening to us. come to the show and explain to us that.
Hey, he clearly doesn't mind doing podcast interviews. We could get him.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, I'm sure he has time.
Yeah, he only scores like one movie a year. Or he has like one movie come out every year that he scores. He's probably working on like three or four different scores at one time.
Yeah, we didn't even talk about News of the World that he's got nominated for the Oscar this year, past year. So, yeah, he's busy.
He's probably running out. He probably had to buy a vacation home just to house all of the trophies that he gets.
And he's 70. Like,
that's crazy.
He could still do this for a while.
Yeah.
Yeah, because speaking of old composer, let's talk about John Williams.
Brilliant segue. Love it.
Because the film composer, I would argue.
Yeah, of course. Of course. But yeah, because of course it's John Williams who set the reference for the Harry Potter movies and for the Wizarding World, I guess. So I try to look if I can find influence in Fantastic Beasts score coming from John Williams' piece of music. So obviously we have Hedwig's theme at several points in the two movies. Mm-hmm. But I think we were afraid at first that it would be overused, and I think it's not. It's very carefully placed at meaningful moment. It's always on the openings, but very discreet. Mm-hmm. And actually, in Fantastic Beasts 2, it's very, very close to Nicholas Hooper version of the opening in movie 6. It's so, so close from the dark opening of movie 6.
Huh.
Yeah.
I can definitely see that.
Yeah, and that. It's also used in Jacob and the Alchemy's birth. So it's very important because it's the first, it's Jacob discovering the bright side of magic with this little Alchemy. So it fits the Harry's discovering the Wizarding World theme, I guess. And of course, in movie 2, Hogwarts. And it's so close to the Williams orchestration, this part, that they didn't even put it in the album. We don't have this part of Hedwig's theme in the soundtrack because it's just Williams' piece of work, I guess. So.
It's just a sprinkle. He just puts the da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and then that's it. That's it.
Oh, it's quite heavy. I look back to the scene, and it's really this view of Hogwarts, and then the bridge, and then we see the students on the windows, and we see the door opening. It's a large piece of music, but it's exactly Williams' orchestration. Mm-hmm. So,
what's curious is that they always talk about John Williams' influence on the Harry Potter scores, and admittedly for good reason. He wrote some of the more iconic themes. He scored the first three films, but there were five films that he didn't score.
Yeah.
And James Newton Howard, you know, having now been consistent in scoring the Fantastic Beasts films, he's had to answer questions about like the influences of John Williams before, but I can't really find much of a connection between his scores for the Fantastic Beasts films and the other five Potter films, except some of
Nicholas
the
Hooper's.
Less.
Yeah.
Some of the what?
I mean, Nicholas Hooper's work on the movie 6. It's quite. Yeah, I think it's quite close to what he's doing in Fantastic Beasts, but I don't know.
There's a. It's not like one particular theme, but there are some of the less serious moments in both Fantastic Beasts movies. There's this kind of da 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 sort of walking along. Mm. It always reminds me of that theme. It's one of my favorite parts of the Order of the Phoenix movie. The theme that they came up with for the montage where Umbridge is making everybody miserable at Hogwarts.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you're right. That's it's a good one, too.
Mm. Like, he's very, very careful not to use motifs that are too directly close. Like, it's not like the same intervals or the same keys or even the same orchestrations, but you can definitely tell like he's spent time paying attention. Like, he goes to see a movie, and when you study music, and he admittedly he dropped out of college and then managed to become really great at this anyway, but when you study music seriously for years as he has, and then you go see a movie and the music is part of the film going experience, you hear it differently.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so too. And sometimes the parallel that I found is just in the, it's not in the motifs or in the melody, it's just, I don't know, I'm not a musician, so that's just the mood. And I think the part of the festival chase in Crimes of Grindelwald is very close to Quidditch Third Year from John Williams in The Prisoner of Azkaban. Because we, of course, visually we have broomstick in the thunderstorm, mm-hmm. so yeah, it fits. But yeah, the way this chase scene and this action scene is called is very close, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's a feeling kind of thing. Like you don't yeah. always, you when you, and this happens a lot when I listen to film score soundtracks, is that I don't always, like, I'm not going to necessarily walk away humming it. I'm not going to necessarily remember exactly what it was. But I'm going to remember how it made me feel.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it's really difficult to recapture things like that. But that's part of why people like James Newton Howard do this for a living and I don't, is because he knows how.
Yeah. And speaking of feeling, I'm also obsessed with something since I first saw Nagini's scene. I don't know why, but I was sure that it was Voldemort's theme used in the background when we have this very dark theme before she turned into the snake.
Mm-hmm.
And I listened, I don't know how many times, the score to find that. And I didn't find the exact motif, like we said earlier. It's not that. But it's almost that. Because I think if you, for Voldemort, because we just have Voldemort theme in the first two movies from John Williams. And we just have this something very something like that, and mm-hmm. Nagini's
yes,
is something. It's very very similar, but it's not the same. So, but I don't know if it was intentional, if it's just me connecting the dots because I want to see that. But that's my obsession since 2018.
Sure.
Yeah, but speaking of motifs particular for Fantasy Beasts, there is, it's just wow. There is a lot of things to talk about, so maybe we will not talk about everything, but maybe one of the main theme, it's hard to say what is the main theme of Fantasy Beasts. Mm-hmm. Because of course we have the opening but not sure it's the main theme because we don't have it apart from the opening, but we have this other theme. I think it's the Wizarding World theme, I don't know, and we have that a lot in movie one, in There Are Witches Among Us, very mysterious, very majestic in Makuza headquarters. It's the music when they enter Makuza. The melody is something like that.
Mm-hmm. That's the one I think of whenever I think of like the Fantastic Beasts theme.
Yeah,
like
because it's so present in movie one. It's very very heavy, and in movie two we have less of it, but we still have a very nice cello version in Newt and Jacob Back to Paris. It's there. And we also have, of course, an epic version in Once Into the Earth at the end when they defeat Grindelwald's flame. So, yeah. Once Into the Earth is one of my favorite pieces.
Is anyone else disappointed that Nicholas Flamel didn't have a theme music?
I mean, but he kind of has in Once Into the Earth. But it's used only once, so we can't call it a motif. But
right. No. See, that's what I'm getting at. It's like I'm going through the soundtrack for Crimes of Grindelwald as I'm listening to it, and I'm thinking, wait a minute. I feel like Nicholas Flamel should have been a moment in
because
this
we have
score.
Very a distinct moment when he appears in something like that.
Right.
But we have it only there, so yeah. Speaking of theme that I'm kind of disappointing, it's Newt's theme, because we have very distinct Newt's theme in movie one and in the Inside the Case. And I can't find it in Crimes of Grindelwald.
That's true.
Yeah, you're right. So,
but also, yeah, in a way, the main theme is Newt's theme. You think about it that way.
That's how I thought about it, because when I listened to Inside the Case on the soundtrack for the first film, it switches up a lot, but that makes sense, because for that scene, they go from being in an apartment to being in a workshop, and then they go through all these different ecosystems, and then my favorite part of that track is when they come to a grinding halt and suddenly it gets very ethereal and very serious, because you mm-hmm. can pinpoint, this is one of my favorite things to do when I listen to film score soundtracks, is I'm trying to remember, based on what I'm hearing, exactly what's going on in the movie at these moments where it changes. And yeah, you can pinpoint exactly the moment where mm-hmm. Jacob accidentally finds that Obscurious.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Sure.
Those moments are so tricky because the timing has to be exact. When you have an orchestra and they have a screen up behind the orchestra and the conductor's got his headphones on and their headphones on and they're trying to time it just right so that it lines up, those moments are so difficult to get.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But yeah, I wonder if this... this bright side of Inside the Case, the we don't have it in movie 2, so yeah.
I wish we had.
And we have Jacob's theme, very present in movie 1, not so much in movie 2, but we still have it. But yeah, it's I love this theme. I think it's the one that anchor movie 1 in this New Yorker in the 20s feel. And yeah.
Thank goodness
this is
for
one
that
of my favorites.
Theme.
Yeah, I love it.
Because that moment where he's kissing Queenie in the rain.
I was just going to mention that's one of my favorite score moments.
I'm like suddenly feeling very, very seasonally depressed. And then it's quiet. And then as soon as it hits him, he's like, wait, where am I? What's going on? Yeah, and then the theme kicks in. It's like, oh, okay, I feel better now. Happy, fun Jacob theme music. Yay.
Yeah.
That's such a good, it really goes, it's like really sad, and then it goes more into romantic, and then, yeah, it gets really quiet, and then it's just like, oh, normal day.
Yeah, Jacob's not what
it's really wow. good.
And then he sat in the factory, but not for long, because he's going to open a bakery.
Yeah.
Yay. Yeah, no, that's a very, very nice theme.
I feel like it stands out from the rest of the soundtrack, from the rest of the score, like, more than anything.
Yeah, because we have this Jacob's piano, music. Very distinct piano for this theme that's quite different. And actually, when we have this theme back in movie 2, it's not on the piano, it's with a light flute, and it's in, again, Newt and Jacob back for Paris, we have this theme. Yeah. So, another great theme that we have a lot in movie 1, and we also have it in movie 2, it's Newtina theme. So, I was wondering if it was specifically Tina's theme. Maybe it is. Not sure, but it's definitely what connects Newt and Tina, because it's it appears in A Close Friend, which is just beautiful. And we have it in Newt Release the Thunderbird, and of course, Newt says goodbye to Tina. And in movie 2, in Salamander's Eyes.
Uh-huh.
And before that, Newt tracks Tina. It's very funny how it's used in Newt tracks Tina, because it's really when Newt finds the trace, Tina's shadows, Tina's trace, we have this theme, and it's really, really fun.
Now, but does that kind of musically pinpoint that they rely a little bit too heavily on the romance between Newt and Tina for her to be relevant to the story? Because she doesn't get a theme. You could argue Newt gets a theme, Jacob gets a theme, a lot of other characters get themes, but she doesn't get one that belongs just to her, because the theme that's associated with her is the one that musically ties her to Newt.
But interestingly, I discover preparing this episode that we have another version of this theme, very different, and it's Nagini, Nagini's track. It's a very dark version of this theme, when everything blows up and we have a very, very heavy, and it's the same theme, and we have there, because Tina is in the middle of this chaos, and we just have it because Tina is there. We don't have it because Newt is there. So that's why I'm, maybe it's indeed Tina's theme, but they introduce it really close to Newt, so yeah. I don't know. But a film that is definitely connected to Lita's is what we get in Lita's flashback. And it's very complex. We have a lot of film in there, and we have this film that we have also in the opening, the oh, oh, oh. And I think that's not Lita's film there. It's just this film connected to the secret of this movie. But the rest of Lita's film is very, very beautiful too.
There's Newt and Lita on the soundtrack for Crimes of Grindelwald. But every musical theme connected to Lita is so sad.
It is.
Yeah. It's all so sad.
Yeah.
And the one that always sticks out for me is on the soundtrack for Crimes of Grindelwald, there's a solo piano version of what is titled Lita's theme. And it just feels like it's sad and light and floating in the air like her blanket, Boggart.
Oh, yeah.
That's a good comparison.
Yeah, but the theme connected to this blanket is really the theme that we have at the beginning of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, we have it in the beginning of the movie because you see it in the bonus in the Blu-ray that it was supposed we're supposed to open the movie with this. Movie with this picture of the floating blanket in the sea, the sinking blanket, and it's why we were supposed to. It's because we were supposed to have this image opening the movie that we have this theme, and they suppress the image, but they keep the theme that is not connected to anything now in the beginning of the movie, but that's the ghost of the ghost. So, yeah,
it's interesting.
Yeah, and to close our sad themes, just before we start recording, I found a last thing that crushed me, and it's Jacob and Queenie.
No!
So
just rip off the Band-Aid.
Yeah, so we talked about Jacob's farewell earlier, and there is a lot of different motifs in this piece, and at the beginning of the scene, we have a nice, sad melody played by the violin. And actually, we find this melody, this motif, again in Crimes of Grindelwald, in Queenie's search for Jacob. But there, it's the theme that we hear with the female voice, the female choir. And it's the exact theme that we have at the beginning of Jacob's farewell. So first, I was, okay, good. But worst, later in Jacob's farewell, we have just four notes looping. I think it's a oboe. It's just these four notes looping. And guess where we have this exact same four notes looping in a very different, sad, epic way in Spread the Words during the Walk With Me moment.
Oh my gosh!
And I'm so sad and happy to have found that because I'm obsessed with this moment of Spread the Words. Every time it makes me cry. And I know why it makes me cry, because the scene is awful, it's perfect and awful. Yeah. But also this music, why this four notes, it's not a recognizable motif. Why? And when I discovered that it's exactly what the theme of Jacob deciding to leave under the rain, and now it's Queenie leaving.
Man, those little motif things, they really get into your brain. They really get into your head, and you're like, you don't even like think about it that much until you do, and then it's like,
yeah.
Whoa.
So that's what I'm getting at, is that you don't always remember what they are. Some people do, some people don't. Some people just have a better capacity for things like that, but you're going to remember how it made you feel.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yep, 100%.
I mean, that's what a lot of behind the scenes movie magic is. And my brother-in-law is a lighting designer in theater, but like a lot of the same kind of principles is in movie making. It's like, we don't think about lighting in movies a lot, but that really affects your
It's
emotions.
Very important.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, we did something. It's Amy who talked about photography in an episode. It was just wow.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's. I mean, there is a lot of other themes we could talk about. Dumbledore's theme and other one, but I think, yeah, for
yeah,
today,
we could do a part
enough.
Two at the
which
very
I'm
least.
Sure we will.
Yeah.
So stay tuned.
Plus, we'll we're get gonna another have movie. Another we'll movie another in a very short time. So
yes,
no doubt we will
score.
Have more to discuss.
Yeah.
Yes.
And one last thing that I want to say about this, I was flipping through James Newton Howard's complete list of films that he's scored. He hasn't done that many franchises or like series where he's living in this world. Like he did The Hunger Games.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And
mm-hmm.
he did the first two Christopher Nolan Batmans. I don't think he did The Dark Knight Rises.
I don't think so. But I think that's because he did Hunger Games that they thought, okay, for Fantastic Beasts, we want this type of, this type of work where, because what he did with Ruth Farwell, again, that's what he's doing with a lot of different motifs in Fantastic Beasts for at least the first two. So, yeah, they were right to trust him with that. Yeah. So that's it for my part of the of this segment, long segment / main discussion.
Very good.
All right, well, Jeff, I think you've got some Nomads movie magic for us.
I do.
Ladies and gentlemen, please find your seats. Nomads movie magic is about to begin.
Since we were talking about the great James Newton Howard, and I have to admit one last thing before I move on from James Newton Howard, when we were talking about our favorite scores that were not Fantastic Beasts by James Newton Howard, I did something that I have actually done several times in the past and the other way around. I confused James Newton Howard for James Horner, and I said that my favorite non-Fantastic Beasts score was How the Grinch Stole Christmas.
How embarrassing for you.
I have to cleanse my soul by coming clean about that faux pas. But that whole thing kind of made me think about just the history of film scores in general and how music is incorporated into films, and I found a lot. I mean a lot. And I condensed it down to a very, very short, brief history of what I call fantastic film scores and where they came from.
Hey!
Nice.
So when we first started with music and film, it wasn't even a score that was written for the film, because you start off with silent films that had no recorded audio, and so you needed something to go with the action, because the dialogue is on title cards in between people saying it. So what they would do is usually have in front of the screen, there would be a pianist, and they would have music that was either put together by them or provided for them to give them an idea of what was being looked for, and then they would be able to provide background music. They would kind of underscore the action of what was going on so that you could really feel it better. And it also, I didn't think about this until I did some research for this, but it also helped kind of cover up the distracting noise from the projector, because projectors were really, really noisy back in the day.
Yeah.
Like, I can even remember when I first started going to see movies, I could hear that projector up in the booth.
Yeah.
So you kind of need something to distract from that. If you had some larger movies, as movies started to scale much bigger, you might, if you had a bigger budget and a bigger film, you might have an organ or even a whole orchestra or a band. And what was interesting about these early films that were silent that had the music being performed live along with the movie is that you could go see the same movie more than once. And you could actually feel like you were watching a different movie if your musicians were savvy enough to change up what was being played.
Wow, interesting.
I love that.
That's so fun.
Like, imagine going to see, like Fantastic Beasts and where to find them. And then you go to see Fantastic Beasts and James Newton Howard comes out and says, okay, so I actually wrote a different score we didn't use. Here's how the movie would feel if we used that one instead. Can you imagine that?
You know, there's actually a an outdoor performance space near me, Ravinia, and they do movies with a live orchestra every summer.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah.
A couple of years ago, we went to see The Wizard of Oz, and I'm just thinking, like, how that would have been with a completely different score. That would have been so cool.
Oh, yeah. They do that all the time. They've done that with, I think, at least most of the Harry Potter movies.
Yeah.
Especially, I feel like John Williams is a really big go-to for that, because even people who don't know that much about film scores, like, they know John Williams.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
And they know his themes. And so if you say you're going to do something that has a John Williams score to it, like, orchestras won't be able to sell the tickets fast enough. But speaking of specific scores, the first movie to actually have a specific set score, not necessarily original music, but the score was set, was the 1915, I believe. It was a silent film called Birth of a Nation. Yeah. And the first movie to have a completely original score composed specifically for it was King Kong.
Huh.
That's really interesting.
At that point, movie studios started to actually have on their staff composers. That was their job. They created the music scores for these films. And the process of creating, writing those things down, recording them was very, very different in those days. I mean, things were still being handwritten. Composers had to write out notes by hand. They didn't have, like, the software that composers are able to use now.
Yeah.
But throughout kind of the 1940s is really when you started to see a change in not only the composers writing music to enhance the film, but the composers for films were starting to become kind of celebrities in their own right, almost, because they were able to express themselves more artistically, and they were being thought of as, instead of just enhancing the action, like, certain composers, if they had a good style or if they were popular enough and the films that they were scoring were popular enough, then they were more likely to get hired. And studios realized that they could actually save a lot of money instead of just keeping people on their staff to write scores for their films. The idea of hiring freelance composers on an as-needed basis, it was a lot cheaper.
This stuff is always just, like, makes me think about how young movies are as a medium, and it's just so wild.
Oh yeah. It's only like, you know, it only goes back like barely more than 100 years.
Yeah,
like the first movie was what, like 1907, right? That was the train chase,
sounds right,
something like that. Yeah. And it's like, but that, you know, that's nothing like what a movie is today. It's like,
sure,
no, but one thing that's been consistent the whole time is,
yeah,
it really has. One thing that will never change and has never changed is that the entertainment business is a business. They're always going to bring in as much money as possible and spend as little money as possible, which is why now the idea of the freelance composers is so appealing.
Well, it's kind of the same thing with a lot of other film positions. I mean, it used to be like actors were very much signed on to one studio and were in all of their films and stuff.
Oh, sure. See, now you have kind of creative teams, I feel like, that get put together. Like, consider Tim Burton. Tim Burton always uses Helena Bonham Carter and Johnny Depp and certain other people, like Timothy Spall has been in a lot of his movies. He usually is working with Danny Elfman as a composer, and it's probably not just them. Like, he hires people, like, I feel like Colleen Atwood is probably just, like, the most in-demand costume designer in Hollywood.
Oh, 100%.
We can go all day on that.
Yeah, or you get people who sign a contract for multiple films in a franchise.
Mm-hmm. Right, like you have like your Sebastian Stans, your Chris Evans.
Yeah, or even behind the scenes people. I mean, obviously, James Newton Howard's doing all these movies.
Right. The people who don't get enough credit, like the people who do jobs that you don't think of as a job, like the prop master for all the Harry Potter movies.
Oh, yeah,
all
like Mina Lima.
Yeah.
Yeah, Mina Lima.
Like, you don't think of a prop master when you go see a movie as, you don't think, wow, I wonder who the prop master was for this movie. They did a really great job. You just see all the cool things and you're like, oh, I love it.
Yeah, it's almost
but
like
they
people
deserve
are
credit
more
too.
Tied to each other and more tied to franchises than tied to a studio. But obviously you do see the same people working for the same studios.
For sure.
Over again, but.
But getting back to the evolution of film scoring, in the 1950s and the 1960s, you started to see a lot more incorporation of contemporary styles of popular music like jazz and rock and roll. And there were people like Miles Davis was brought in to help score a couple of films. And with things like that, if you could have film scores that were performed by a smaller ensemble, then you could, that's also something that studios could see as being a positive because it's cost effective and it brings more people in. Like, you find out that a movie that has kind of a jazzy feel to it is being scored by somebody big like Miles Davis, then some people are going to come just to probably hear the music.
Sure.
And they also, at this point, this is when you kind of, as you move forward, you start to see the incorporation of popular songs that are released on albums or played on the radio or played by your favorite musicians, your favorite bands, and they start to incorporate those into films as well, which is when you have the commercial sale of movie soundtracks, because it's not just the score that people are interested in anymore. They want to hear the songs that they like, that they also mm-hmm. hear on the radio. You make that part of the film, and then the soundtrack is going to sell a lot better that way. Like, the thing that comes to mind the most for me when I think about songs being associated with films, not just scores, is the Bond films.
Oh, 100%.
Like, there is always a song.
Yeah.
And those songs have a tendency to win all the awards. Like, Adele's Skyfall.
Yeah.
Sam Smith's The Writing's on the Wall. And now Billie Eilish has come out with No Time to Die.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Love those. Not a whole lot. Based on just what the research I was able to put together, there wasn't a ton of what you might call innovations in film scoring in the 1970s, but that is when John Williams wrote the score for Star Wars. And now I'd like to welcome you to a little place I call the hill that I'm prepared to die on. John Williams' score for Star Wars is the most iconic film score of all time.
I agree with that.
No, I
you
think that's
You may
fair.
Fight me if you want, but you will lose.
No, I agree. And speaking of what changed in the 70s, I don't know if you saw the documentary Making Waves, The Art of Cinematic Sound. And that's just a fascinating documentary. And it's not about soundtrack. It's more about soundtrack is just a part of it. It's all the sound. And they talk a lot about Star Wars, and also the guy, the sound guy, I don't remember, but it's just a legend in sound design. And yeah, a lot changed technically in the 70s, and it makes the sound so much better in the cinema. They change because before the you didn't, if I mean, between having a live band in the theater and having the very nice sound that started to appear in the 80s in the cinema, you had very crap sound in movie theater. So mm-hmm. it changed a lot in this period of the 70s, so, and affect the soundtrack, of course. I'm just remembering, I wasn't just watch Making Waves. It's really, really interesting.
I definitely will. So that's another one of those things that you don't really think about when you go to actually watch the movie, but when you see it all laid out from where it was before to where it is now, you realize how important developments like that are, because they really create a much better film.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Having somebody in charge of actually making sure that things like that are as they should be.
Yeah.
In the 1980s and the 1990s, you had the development of personal computers, synthesizers, electronic instruments, and digital music. And what this allowed was that, in addition to more sophisticated recording technology so that you could get a cleaner sound, it meant that you could actually have a film that could be scored, and if your budget was low and your movie wasn't going to be huge, like, I'm thinking of independent films where you don't mind having synthetic sounding instruments, you could have a film score that could be written and recorded by a single person.
Wow.
I've seen it done. Not with huge, big budget movies, but like, I was fortunate enough when I was in, especially thinking of when I was in my master's program, there's a huge influence on music recording and audio engineering and film scoring and songwriting at that program that I was in. And what happened a lot of times is you would have film students who would be working on a project, and they would need composers who would also need a project to work on. So they would frequently collaborate with each other to create a single film, and then that way everybody got credit for it.
Yeah.
But you had film scores where they would actually write out the score in a recording software so that it would be synthetic strings and brass instruments. They wouldn't actually record them acoustically. But thankfully, that kind of technology has gotten sophisticated enough that even if it isn't actual instruments being played, it sounds close.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can really do a lot by yourself now. Technology. Which brings us to today. What I just kind of mentioned is that composing for film and television is something that you can actually study and get a degree in at universities now. And so it's not necessary. Like James Newton Howard, he went to music school for a little while and then he dropped out. He's not the first, he won't be the last. So it's not necessary. But when I was in my master's program, my mentor taught me that going to college to get a degree should never be a means to an end. Like, you should never get a degree or a certificate because you think you'll get hired to do the job you want to do because you have it. Mm-hmm. It's about putting as many tools in your kit as possible so that you can do the job better when you get the opportunity to do it. Yes. If you're really good enough to do it, then you'll get the opportunity if you shoot your shot.
Yes. And again, for on this topic, the score episode with James Newton Howard, he talks about this fact that he dropped out school, and what advice he would give for the younger generation about that. And he has very interesting things to say about that. So,
That reminds me a lot of, like, I got an English degree. And that's very, you know, English degrees are useless. But it's like, but I did it because, I mean, you know, I'm privileged enough that I had the money and the scholarships to do it. That's part of it. But it was like, I wanted to hone my craft more. It was not mm-hmm. about having the degree. Because, it is useless. But...
You know what? When I got out of my master's program, I worked at a student loan company counseling delinquent borrowers over the phone for 2 years. And I'm here to tell you that if you went to college to get a degree in a field and then you went straight into that field and started working in it, you're in the minority of people.
Yeah, who are you?
People don't do that now. I don't know if people ever actually did it. Maybe it's just a myth they told us so we'd go to college. I don't know.
I also got a communications degree, and that kind of applies to everything, so...
Yeah, like those degrees, that I could see being a very, very useful course of study.
Yeah, that was a good, like, well, let's just kind of learn how to communicate. Now I'm a podcaster, so if you think about it that way...
You're communicating every day.
Yeah,
you're using your skills.
Yeah,
exactly.
Last thing I want to say about the brief history of film composition that I've put together is that when you look at who is actually scoring films these days, it's kind of incredible what they do in the meantime, because it just, I mean, the most recent winner of the Academy Award for Best Original Score was for the movie Soul. That one was written by John Batiste, Atticus Ross, and Trent Reznor. John Batiste, if you don't know him, he's the band leader for The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. Incredibly talented musician, just heck of a nice guy from what I've heard. But Trent Reznor is the front man for the band Nine Inch Nails. I won't even get into half of what I've read about Trent Reznor from books written by other people, but this guy has at least 2 Academy Awards for film scores. He and Atticus Ross also won for The Social Network.
Yeah, I was saying, like, The Social Network soundtrack is so good.
Again, and it like, really you is. Know, Soul, amazing score, and the score is like the point of the movie.
Well, yeah. It would have to be. This is a movie about jazz musicians.
Such a good movie.
So great. But no, from what I had ever read about Trent Reznor, if you had told me that that guy was going to end up winning Oscars for film scores, I would have thought you were lying. Let's just say, doesn't strike you as the type, but shame on you for thinking that, I guess.
Don't judge people. Also, if you're someone who's like unsure about your degree and if you're going into the right field and jobs and stuff, watch Soul.
Yeah.
True.
You'll really get that. It's a good movie.
So that is my fantastic film scores and where they came from, Nomadge Movie Magic segment.
Love it. Thank you for sharing that with us. That was fascinating.
Oh, yes.
Much more fun to put together than my presentation on Prohibition, although that one has some surprisingly fun things in it. So for our podcast question of the week, we're going to bring it back to our Phoenix Register discussion about the upcoming Fantastic Beasts movie, and we want to know, what do you think the secrets of Dumbledore are, or which of Dumbledore's secrets are they? And we'd love to hear your guys' thoughts on this, so if you want to drop us an owl on any of our social media outlets, or you can email us at speakbeastie@gmail.com, and as always, we would love it if you would leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts.
You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at speakbeastie, Facebook at facebook.com/speakbeastie, Tumblr at speakbeastiepodcast.tumblr.com. You can also support the show on patreon.com/speakbeastie. We do have some very cool stickers that subscribers receive every month. And also, we've had some really great Patreon content. I know that, Shannon, you put together some character playlists.
Yeah.
Marjolaine, we just released Marjo's video of her cooking from Thea's book.
Yeah.
Jeff, anything cool coming up?
I read a fan fiction called Lights, Camera, Strike a Pose. And I realized in putting that together, I'm having a little bit of a tough time finding fan fiction that is not too long, but also appropriate for sharing it with our patrons. And that's all I'm going to say about that.
Welcome to the world of Harry Potter fan fiction, bro.
Tell me about it. Now, if anybody happens to come across any fan fictions that they would like to hear read out loud by somebody who is prone to doing funny voices and accents that are questionable, I would be happy to bring those to life for the listeners if they would care to send them in.
Nice. Speakbeastie@gmail.com. Send us your fanfics.
Yes. Send us your fanfics and I will read them out loud.
Well, I think that wraps it up. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in to this XXL episode of Spook Beastie. I'm Anne.
I'm Jeff.
I'm Marjolaine.
And I'm Shannon. Case closed.